And welcome to Dragons Made Me Do It, one of potentially many podcasts about Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern series, but the only one by us.
I'm Shay.
And I'm Tequila Mockingbird.
And today we are talking about possibly, as I think about it, the book I listened to the most as a child, in part just because it's so long. I probably spent more hours listening to this book than I did listening to Dragon Song or Dragon Singer. I think this was your first time reading it, though.
Yeah, I never read it. I vaguely remember that there were dolphins. And I think, honestly, my little 12-year-old self was like, we've jumped the shark. I'm sorry. This is just one step too far.
Well, your 12-year-old self was so wrong, because this book is great. Dolphins of Pern, published in 1994, is once again overlapping in part with the plot of All the Weirs of Pern. So at one point in All the Weirs of Pern, when Jaxum is looking for stuff for Ivis, he visits Jake and Aramina, our old friends from Renegades of Pern, at Paradise Riverhold, their new settlement. And he hears a fun story from their son, Redis, who tells him about how he and Alemi were rescued by Shipfish, who he says told them they were called dolphins. And Jackson's like, huh, that's interesting. I'll have to make inquiries into that. All the Weirs of Pern does not follow up on this, but Dolphins of Pern is all about this. It starts with a little prologue about dolphins 100 years after landing, and then we jump to Redis and Alemi going out fishing and getting caught in a sudden storm and then being rescued by dolphins. So our main characters are Redis, the son of Jake and Aramina. I would say he is the protagonist of the book, but there are two major secondary protagonists. One is Alemi, Menelie's older brother, who you may remember from Dragon Song, who is now the master fisherman at Paradise River Hold, and also Talion, who is a young bronze rider who was not supposed to impress, accidentally impressed a bronze dragon at the hatching that his older brother was a candidate for, and so early in the novel has a mostly full-grown bronze dragon, but also is 12, and so is mostly assigned to transportation duty, carrying people back and forth between various places in the southern continent and landing. Alemi, Redis, and Talion all become involved with dolphins in various ways to varying extents, but crucially, Redis's parents, and especially his mother Aramina, do not want him to be involved with dolphins, and this becomes a recurring point of contention throughout the book, especially after Redis gets some kind of sea thorn in his foot that causes him to become seriously ill, almost kills him, and leaves him with one wasted leg. That means he has difficulty walking. He has a horse, or maybe a pony, possibly, based on some of the descriptions, that he rides to get places because walking long distances is difficult for him. Ultimately, after a big storm sweeps in and devastates large portions of the coast, including stuff at Paradise River, Redis gets in trouble with his parents for prioritizing caring for the dolphins because the humans were all busy on land. And Redis was like, well, the dolphins are also injured and they need help. So he and Talion give them some medical attention. And then Redis's parents say, and especially his mother says, either promise me you will never speak to a dolphin again, or you can't live in my house. And Redis says, okay, then I can't live in this house. Bye. And goes to live in the woods and meets some new dolphins, then is reintegrated into society when the Tillic, who is the leader of all the dolphins on Pern, comes to visit him, takes him out to sea, where he meets a fishing boat full of all of our favorite characters. Menelie's there, Lessa and Falara are there, his parents are there, Master Fisher Eidorolin is there, Master Rampisi from Southern Hold is there for some reason.
Lord Otterell is there, even though he's dead.
Right. And they all say, wow, Redis, you've done such a good job. And Teresa approves, so you can be a dolphineer and set up a dolphineer craft hall at your little cave that you found. Wow, isn't that a fun, nice ending that's still really fucked up in a bunch of ways that we'll talk about. The other thing that happens in this book is Torek is there, and Torek is plotting to seize a bunch of land that he is not entitled to, and the Weirs, who have been given the responsibility for distributing land in the southern continent according to the terms of the charter, find out that Torek is planning this and stop him from doing it.
And you might be thinking, those two plots don't really sound like they have a lot to do with each other, and you'd be right.
As I was saying as we were discussing this before the novel, I don't think the Torek stuff is bad, but the Torek stuff is completely disconnected from the other stuff that's going into the plot, except insofar as the one upside of how weird and boring All the Weirs of Pern is that All the Weirs of Pern made this book possible. This book is everything that I wanted from All the Weirs of Pern and didn't get. It is entirely about the lived experience of all of the social, political, technological, etc. changes that happen as a result of working with Ivis and rediscovering Pern's past.
It's also really a Southern Continent book.
Yeah, so this is the first book that we've had that's really basically entirely in Southern, which is an interesting change of pace. Everything feels kind of new, and the result is that there's a lot more time and attention given to all of the new things that are happening, not moving towards the teleology of we're getting rid of Thread, but rather how is life on Pern changing? That's what this book is about, and I think it's quite good at that.
Yeah, and one of the ways that life on Pern is changing is that life on Pern is becoming more socially, politically concerned with the Southern continent, as it's becoming the nexus of these new social mores and political expansion and technological advancements. And I think nowhere is that more exemplified than in The Dolphins.
Yeah.
Because this is a big change in Pernie's life. We have rediscovered a third sapient species on the planet. And that's a big deal, even if they're maybe not treating it as if it is a big deal.
Which is sort of the thing, right? We're at this transition point where more people are becoming aware of the existence of dolphins, but a lot of people still regard them as basically just fish, or don't really grasp the implications of there being a third intelligent speaking species on this planet. One question that we both were coming up against, unfortunately, as we read this is, how the fuck did they forget about dolphins? And I think you were a little more stuck on this than I was.
Yeah, here's the thing. It fundamentally doesn't make sense. The problem is that she then tries to explain it, and that makes it worse and not better. We get a prologue, as you mentioned, from the point of view of one of the dolphins, having realized that the humans forgot them. They're ringing the bell. They're like, the humans aren't coming. What's going on? And the way that Kibbe rationalizes this to himself is, well, humans die. Which is a line that made us both wonder, does this imply that dolphins don't?
Specifically, what we get is they're ringing the bell. Corey, the other dolphin who's there, is mad that no one's answering. And then we have this exchange. There has been illness. Ben told us that, Kibbe reminded her. He was not well, Corey replied, reluctantly employing speech to impart the concept. Humans can die. They do, it is true. What does that mean?
That just sounds like a conversation that two beings who can't die would have.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
So it sounds as if the intended explanation is that there was illness at Fort Hold and I guess all the dolphin ears died.
I'm just baffled by the implication that the only people who knew that dolphins existed were dolphin ears. Like, it's not logical that the number of people who know that dolphins exist and are sapient is a small enough number that they could all have just died of a plague and the population would have continued in Dragonstone. Everybody knows that the dolphins exist. You might not work closely with dolphins, but you know that they're there and you know that they're sapient. So even if you can't work with them anymore, because I remember you were thinking about, okay, well, some of it's just they lose the scuba equipment. And as they don't have the technological capacity to swim underwater with the dolphins in a meaningful way, the dolphineer relationship goes. And I fully believe that. But there's nothing that's stopping a fisherman from listening to a dolphin come up out of the goddamn water and speak in English to them. Mm. And we are in fact told that that continued to happen for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years as the broader community, including the broader fishing community, was like, haha, you're so superstitious. You think they're talking? Like, bitch, what the fuck?
So we're told in Dragon's Eye, which is 257 to 258 years after landing, that the Lord Holder of Ista goes out fishing and talks to dolphins. And people are like, huh, that's kind of crazy. And someone from the college is like, well, actually, according to the records, it is possible. Okay, you're not doing anything with that?
Ask a dolphin! So first of all, I don't believe in it fundamentally. But second of all, I don't believe in it 100 years after landing.
Yeah.
That's 2 or 3 generations at the most.
I agree. I also, though, do think that the fact that we don't get an adequate explanation just kind of doesn't matter. I'm willing to go with it. It's the story that she wanted to tell. And I think the story that she tells with them having forgotten it is a good one. So of all of the continuity things in this series, this is one of the few that I'm like, I don't mind it. It's fine.
Yeah, I will accept it. But I want it noted that I'm doing this under protest.
Noted, yes. So we talked about the prospect of dolphin immortality. I will note that it does also immediately after that conversation say, pod leader and one of the oldest in their pod, Kibbe had had 2 dolphin ears as partners. He still fondly remembered Amy, his first one. She had been as much fish as he, even if she had to wear the long feet and had no fins. She had given the best chin scratches and knew exactly where she had to slough off old skin. When he had been injured, she had stayed in the water by his cradle through the days and nights until she knew that he would recover. He would never have survived that long gash if she hadn't sewn it up and given him the human medicine medicines that prevented infection, which does kind of make it sound like Kibbe outlived, in fact, his first human partner. Make of that what you will.
Yes.
Another upside of dolphins is that for the first time in the whole series, we have a female political leader who holds power in her own right and not as partner or subordinate to a man, namely the Tillic Teresa. It's also kind of implied that the Tillic is always a woman because we're told that the typical structure of dolphin pods is an older or senior female dolphin is the pod leader. Not always, but that's the typical arrangement. And I have to say, it's really nice. It's a really nice change of pace from everything else in the whole series.
Dolphin culture seems great. They're having fun. They're getting stuff done. They have an inexplicably powerful code of ethics because they're still like, well, it has been 2,400 years since the humans kept up their side of the bargain. But that doesn't mean we can slack. And I respect that.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the highlights of this book is the fact that we do get a bunch of typically short passages from the perspective of dolphins responding to humans' renewal of contact. So after the first time that Alemi makes proactive contact with the dolphins, we get this little interlude where the dolphins are delighted by this. They're like, oh my God, it's finally happening. We've been waiting 2,400 years for this. And finally, humans are talking to us again. The news is traveling all through the seas of Pern. And they're like, maybe now they can finally do all the things. We can swim with them again. We can show them where the coastline has changed or where the coastline's changing currently. We can help them find stuff that was lost. Because something else that comes up in this is that they find
the cargo that was lost in the dolphin's bell. It does come back and become relevant. I thought she was leaving too obvious of a little tag for herself there at the end of that one.
Yeah, it's nice because it creates, oh yeah, the callback continuity. And also because it's cool to see none of the conservatism that's going on the human end matters at all to the dolphins. The dolphins are like, finally, we can get to work again. And it's an interesting change of pace from humans who spend so much of the later books in this series going like, all these changes are happening. I don't know how we should feel about this. To have people who are unquestioningly, we gotta move. We're going forward. It's finally happening.
Delighted. I also really liked the way that she handled dolphin point of view and dolphin speech. It feels noticeably different from human speech in a way that I think made sense. It wasn't unreadable, because I do think sometimes trying to write in dialect or trying to deliberately alter speaking patterns to make a character feel alien can bog me down as a reader, and this really didn't.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in part because the dolphins learned to speak English, but they were taught to speak English 2,500 years ago. So they speak with 2,500 years ago accents. And also, most dolphins haven't been using their human speech training regularly. So when they transitioned to adulthood, dolphins were told go to spend some time kind of studying with the Tillic, learning the history of Pern, the history of dolphins, and learning hand signals and human speech, etc. But they don't typically use it among themselves. So it's clear that many of the dolphins that we interact with, especially early in the book, are like, oh yeah, I remember this word I learned in human class 15 years ago.
Which is so charming.
Yeah, it's delightful. And also you can see as the book goes on that they start to get more comfortable with using human speech. Their sentences get longer, they get more grammatical. The characters notice like, oh, they're using more words. They are like, oh, I just remembered this other word. And the human characters are sort of putting it in scare quotes. But I think it's absolutely, yeah, these people took high school human 15 years ago.
And now suddenly they're talking to a bunch of humans being like, oh, damn, yeah.
They're dredging up these things that they learned in 10th grade.
It is intriguing to me to question vowels, because the big difference that we get at the beginning of the book is that the way dolphins say words has more syllables and the vowels sound different. She's phonetically writing some things out, like teach becomes titch, name becomes name, although that one I'm like, that's already how I pronounce it. And it does make me wonder about vowel shifts. We do also know when Ivis shows up that he initially has trouble understanding them and he has to modulate his speech and his listening. And that's a moment where the Harpers are embarrassed because they were thinking that they had kept the language so pure. But we do know that vowel shifts just happen in languages. So it makes me wonder whether Pern has had a great vowel shift since landing.
I think probably, yeah. We also know from even as early as Dragon's Eye, there's significant dialect variation across Pern. We see some Eye dialect Bitrin speech in Dragon's Eye, and then also, of course, Pymer and Siebel are putting on their Crom shepherd voice accent in Dragon Drums.
Mm-hmm. Realistically, I don't think it's plausible that a planet for 2,500 years would have no speech variation, no drift.
Yeah.
Dialects would happen. Indubitably, they would happen. Even without the strong emphasis on remaining in a single community, usually for most of your life.
Yeah.
The Holds can get very isolated and very autonomous, and that's what makes dialects happen. And then you also have the Weirs, where you're pulling people from a bunch of different areas, which is what makes pigeons happen.
Yeah.
She's already deliberately foreignizing a lot of the words in these books. We have herd beasts. We have footstrap for instead of stirrups. She's already deliberately doing that in a lot of ways to try and make it feel not like 21st century Earth. And I think trying to do any kind of dialect writing, as I said, would have been meh. So I think it's fun to now be told in some way that that has happened because it feels plausible.
Yeah. And it does seem like mostly it's vowels that are the problem. Consonants to the extent that dolphins' mouths are different, so they have trouble with certain consonants. But broadly, vowels are the issue, which also is realistic. It's one of the first things that we were taught in my historical linguistics class in undergrad is if you're trying to identify cognates, consonants are the priority because vowels go wild sometimes.
Yeah. Also, I think syllabization and blends, because they're saying swim instead of swim. They're saying ooate instead of wait.
Yeah.
So that is the other thing I noticed about dolphin speech.
I wonder if it's possible that part of it is that dolphins' transmission of human speech over 2,500 years has also perhaps not been perfect.
Yeah.
Especially if maybe not everyone who goes to the Great Subsidence necessarily studies with the Tillich personally.
Mm-hmm.
If the Tillich maybe has a school and not everyone who teaches human at Tillich School is quite as competent at it or has the same accent.
Right, because it is obviously second language transmission the whole way down for 2,500 years.
Yeah.
And we do know, because the Tillich gets microaggressions, that the Tillich speaks in a much more human way.
Yeah. Another thing that came up here, re the dolphins, is are they psychic? And if so, to what extent? We are told that they can hear dragons, but only sort of. They can't distinguish words, but they can hear that dragons are speaking telepathically to their riders. This is something that the dragons wonder about. Gadareth is like, can they hear me?
There is also the impression that at least that degree of empathic awareness is mutual, because it does seem like the dolphins know how the dragons feel about things and are sharing their thoughts with the dragons, or like sharing their vibes.
Yeah, so there's something going on there. And then at the very end, as night is falling over the ship that Redis's family and miscellaneous political leaders are on, they're hearing dolphins singing in the ocean, and Manelie's like, oh my god, is that the dolphins? And they have this moment where everyone's reflecting on, like, I've heard this sound before. And two of the people who are saying this are Manelie, who grew up in a Seahold, and Aramina, who lives in Paradise River, right on the coast. And the other person is Lessa, who grew up in Ruatha, not on the coast, lives at Bend and Weir, also not on the coast. And she specifically says that Ramoth sometimes tells her that she hears this song. Are the dolphins singing telepathically and the dragons are hearing them? Have they been doing that for 2,500 years?
Frankly, I would buy that. And for 2,500 years, the dragons have been like, hey, there's this weird sound. And the humans have been like, don't worry about it, baby. It's all good.
Dragons don't sing, so I knew it wasn't them. But Ramoth has complained about lonely, quote unquote, sounds impinging on her sleep, Lessa said. So I guess maybe they've been singing telepathically and projecting their loneliness and their longing for this renewed contact with humans telepathically, and at least some dragons have been picking this up. Okay. Great. Love that.
Yeah. And to be fair, Ramoth is very special. So it's possible that not all dragons have been hearing it or...
True. Yeah.
But...
Something's afoot.
Mm-hmm.
The last dolphin thing that I wanted to talk about is just dolphin sexuality. The dolphins are, as we saw in the dolphin spell, they're hitting on everyone at all times, basically. But in particular, this book has the first instance in, I believe, the whole series, and possibly the only instance in the whole series, where two male characters kiss. And one of them is a dolphin, and the other one is Selin, the Weir healer at Eastern Weir, who has been caring for this particular dolphin. And after Selin finishes his come back in a few days so I can check the condition of the wound that I've just sewn up treatment, Bougie rises up out of the water and kisses Selin and then swims away. And Selin's like, wow, I wish my human patients expressed their gratitude like that.
First of all, medical ethics.
Yeah, first of all. Second of all, given that the one time in the the series that we have had explicit confirmation of a non-dragon rider being not straight was also the Weir Healer in Moretta. I think we can only conclude from this that healers are the gayest craft.
Yeah, that seems completely canonical to me.
That's dolphins for you. They're great.
Yeah, I think the point at which I noted that the dolphins are just straight up flirting was when Rhydus had run off into the woods and was making contact with Cal's pod.
Rhydus swims out to sea because he's like, well, I don't have a bell, so I can't make contact with dolphins by calling them to me. So all I can do is swim out to sea and make them think I'm drowning. And so they'll come rescue me, probably. Fortunately for him, they do. They swim him back into shore to the cave that he's been staying in and drop him off. So, grabbing the nearest of his homemade water bottles, he returned to the pool and found it stuffed full of dolphins. Is the entire pod inside? Yes. Want to see man's land place, Delphi said, raising her body out of the water to peer about her. Nice place. And she dropped back. It's just so cute.
Yep. They're also noting that he's giving good scritches. I don't know. They're flirty. They're fun.
Yeah.
They're having a great time.
Easy, breezy, beautiful. Dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
Rhydus's relationship to the dolphins brings us to Rhydus in general. Anne McCaffrey fundamentally only actually had a small handful of stories that she was interested in writing and rewriting over and over again. And
she's so valid, I will say.
Yeah. And we both picked one of them, and I hadn't really considered the one that you picked. So tell us about Rhydus and Jaxum.
It did strike me in this book that we are again getting a story about the son of a holder who is supposed to grow up and become Lord Holder and fulfill his social role as a hold man, and then questions that role, does something unexpected, goes against the wishes of the adults in his life, and chooses to become a dolphineer versus become a dragon rider. And in Jaxum's case, he then ends up exactly where he started. He comes back, he's like, no, actually, I'm going to be a Lord Holder in a heterosexual relationship. And we talked about the way that potentially transgressive plot was given a more conservative ending. And so this struck me in some ways as here's the book that the White Dragon could have been, because Rhydus runs away from home and doesn't end up coming back to be a Lord Holder. He ends up coming back to be the leader of a dolphin craft hall. And it's possible he will also inherit, but it honestly felt to me like it was prepping us for the idea that his younger brother is going to inherit the hold.
Yeah.
And there's also, in the same way that there was with Jaxum, some noticeable queer subtext. But unlike with Jaxum, there isn't really the tidy heterosexual relationship.
Yes.
There's a hint that he is supposed to be in a relationship with Cammy, maybe, who is Alemi's daughter.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't honestly say that that was a stronger textual hint than the idea that Rhydus has a crush on Felessen or Talion is.
Yeah, certainly the book ends with Rhydus, who is, we're told now, legally an adult, or at least old enough to be legally recognized as an adult.
Although his age is, like Jaxum's, baffling.
Yeah. So Rhydus is more or less an adult, or at least on the cusp of adulthood. And the end of the book is Talion has also gotten permission to be a dolphineer. So it seems like Rhydus and Talion are maybe going to be living together in Rhydus's cave, studying to be dolphineers, at least when Talion is not busy fighting Thread. Make of that what you will.
And Threadfall is going to end, right? There's only about 20 more years in the past at this point.
Yeah, so much to consider. I, meanwhile, was thinking about Rhydus as Manaly 3.0. So we had Manaly in Dragonsong and Dragonsinger following that up. And then we had Pimer, Manaly 2.0, in Dragon Drums, going completely off the rails, not the way Manaly's plot goes. And then we have Rhydus as Manaly 3.0, where once again we have a pretty direct repetition of it. Child of a hold, difficult relationship with his parents. They're not physically abusive towards him for the most part, in contrast to Manaly's parents, and the gender aspect is not there or not there in the same way, but broadly the dynamic is very similar. Rhydus has this strong interest in something that he is forbidden to engage in or limited in his engagement with, and he finds it impossible to live under these circumstances. He runs away, he lives in the woods, he makes himself pots out of clay that he finds, and he meets a bunch of unambiguously intelligent and speaking creatures and befriends them, and also maybe they're psychic. And then finally a gathering of people that he's kind of trapped into interacting with tell him, actually, it is okay. You can have everything you ever dreamed of, after all.
Da, 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 da.
And he's led into the trap by the leader of the craft that he intends to join. So he's truly just mentally, again, very directly with different gender politics.
And to be fair, I think this is an improvement on the Jackson arc. And I think the mentally arc was one of the best arcs that she ever did. So I'm not mad about this.
Yeah, I'm also not mad about it. In fact, I think it's great. One of the reasons that I think it works so well is because in contrast to Pimer, in contrast to some of the mentally analogs in the later books, also, because there's more of them, don't worry. We have not seen the last of mentally analogs.
I have not yet begun to run away from home.
Rhaedys's experience is grounded once again in the family as a site of violence and control in a way that is, I think, really compelling. And in Dragonsong, the fact that that violence is rooted in the family is sort of obscured by the emphasis on gender and sexism. So to me, Dragonsong ends up kind of implying that if Manaly had been a boy, the fact that her family worked like this would have been fine, or that she wouldn't have been subject to this kind of arbitrary control, which I don't think is necessarily true, first of all.
We do get a passage in this one where Alemi's like, yeah, I had to get out of there.
Right. Literally, Alemi is like, I can't live with my father anymore. Can't stay at Half Circle forever. I gotta go. I'm out of here. So there's clearly something also going on, even for the boys in Manaly's family. But also, the family just is a structure of arbitrary power and social control and violence. And this book, by virtue of having Rhaedys be a boy, makes that, I think, quite unambiguously clear, even though the physical violence is not as much a factor in it. Rhaedys's parents are awful. Eramina in particular, but Jake also.
It was a question that I was asking myself as I was reading this, because the book is not unaware of the parallel to Manaly's childhood.
Yeah.
Because Alemi's right there and he's thinking about it. And so I was curious about whether you felt that the text is suggesting that Jage and Eramina are better than Giannis and Mavi. Because it did feel like they were saying that.
Oh, absolutely. So the problem with this book is that I don't think the book knows that it's presenting a sustained critique of the family as a social structure, but it is. The book very much does think that Jage and Eramina are better parents, quote unquote, than Giannis and Mavi, because they love their son. And they're just doing this because they care about him and they want him to be happy. Okay, so you think Mavi wasn't also doing this? It's because she wanted Manaly to be happy, and she thought that Manaly would be unhappy if she continued to pursue music. Things that were explicitly told and have her tell Manaly in Dragonsong. Hello?
And again, I understand that we did have different interpretations of that in Dragonsong, but to me, the difference in how these two children experience severe physical injury and possible permanent disability is not that strong.
Mm.
There's a question about medical negligence for Manaly, but I think there's also a question about medical negligence for Rhaedys, because the dolphins are communicating that there's a medical issue and they're not listening to them. And as a result, his leg injury is a permanent disability instead of a temporary injury.
Yeah.
And when in fact, Manaly is not permanently disabled by the pack tail and is able to recover most of her hand function.
Yeah. It's also worth mentioning that both Alemi and Manaly appear in this book. So early in the book, Paradise River doesn't have a Harper, and Jagan and Armina's children, and also Alemi and his wife's children, and some other children from among the Hold community, are getting old enough that their parents are like, we need to have a teacher for them now. They can't just be running wild. So Alemi is like, well, let me just impose on my sister the Master Harper, and I'll ask her to send someone for us. And then a couple weeks later, a boat shows up and Manaly gets off the boat. And Alemi's like, oh my god, my sister the Master Harper is here. So that's, first of all, legend. Love that for her. It's very funny.
And I love her energy of like, I am pregnant. It is cold. I will be here now.
Yeah. But second of all, Manaly and Alemi are both here, and both of them actively collude with Eramina to prevent Rhaedys from interacting with dolphins. So at this point, Rhaedys is 5 or 6 or 7, depending on how old you think he is at any point in this book. And he had this transformative experience with dolphins and has always been interested in the ocean and now is especially curious about dolphins. But he's been told that he's not allowed to swim unless someone else is with him. And Jake and Eramina have asked Alemi, who is continuing to interact with the dolphins in his professional capacity as a fisherman, to keep that hidden from Rhaedys. And Alemi's like, okay, I will keep that hidden from Rhaedys. And Manaly also is told to keep that hidden from Rhaedys and is like, yes, children are so distractible. He'll probably move on to something else soon anyway. I'll get right on that. How can you, Manaly, of all people, not recognize the very obvious parallels between your childhood experience and what you are being asked to do for Rhaedys right now?
Well, yes, I think that's a flaw, but I think that's a flaw in mentally and not in the text, because I think there's nothing like working with children to make you see how quickly adults forget what it is like to be a child. And that imposing control upon children is something that our society reinforces in every possible way, and that it is actively difficult, even when you are consciously aware of it, to work against that in a space where that is what is normalized in how we interact with children and take care of them.
Yeah. And I think also it's exacerbated here by the fact that everything in the text, including Alemi and Menelie, is telling us that Jake and Aramina are good parents who love their child. So it might be easier for either Menelie or Alemi to perceive this as a problem if Aramina were
acting like Giannis,
clearly a bad person the way Giannis and Mavi are. But she's not. She seems nice. She performs parental love, does all of the things that she's supposed to do. And so that means that her behavior towards Rita's cannot be bad in the way that their parents were.
It's fair to say that while it's not how I would raise children, I don't have as much of an issue with them trying to redirect Rita's away from dolphins and physical interaction with dolphins at the age of 6 as I do at the age of 10. Because I do think it's fair to say my child is obsessed with the ocean and it is very easy for small children to drown.
Yeah.
I don't want him thinking this is fun and sneaking away and going to play with this. And frankly, I do believe that, especially if you're not completely sold on dolphin intelligence, you might be worried that an enthusiastic dolphin might not realize that this kid is not a strong swimmer and an accident could happen. Mm-hmm. What my issue is that I think just never mentioning it again is in fact the number one best way to get your kid to lie to you, sneak away, and play with the dolphins outside of your supervision.
Yeah.
And I think if you actually were worried about his safety, the best method would have been to be like, yes, we can visit the dolphins with a grown-up, and you have to be with a grown-up at all times.
Yeah.
Give him parameters and supervise him if what you're worried about is safety and not control. But I do think it's fair to suggest that they are worried about safety and control.
Well, the thing is, the worry about safety, Rita's obeys his parents' instructions. That's one of the major points of contention through the whole book, is that Rita scrupulously, from the time his mother makes him promise that he will never swim alone, he doesn't. Never once in the whole book until he runs away, basically because she accuses him of having broken his promise. And he's like, no, I have always done exactly what I said I would do. I've never swum alone. I've always had someone with me. I've always had someone, in fact, older than me supervising me, because Talion is somewhere between 5 and 7 years older than him. And his mother's like, you've been doing stuff with dolphins. He's like, I promised I would not swim alone. I've never swum alone. You can't hold this against me. And she's like, essentially, that wasn't the point. The point was you should do what I say at all times, always, and also you should never be near the dolphins. And Rita isn't like, that's not what you made me promise. Bye.
Honestly, for me, the strongest argument that the text thinks Aramina and Jage are better than Giannis and Mavi is that they get an ending. They come back. They say sorry.
Yeah.
They get that scene at the end where they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize. And it's like, really? You didn't realize? Okay. Now we're all fine with this, in a way that I think both is reflective of the degree to which McCaffrey doesn't think that what they did is that big of a deal.
Yeah.
And is reflective of the rushed pacing of the end of this book.
Yeah.
Where the reconciliation happens in 3 sentences because the whole interaction happens in 3 pages.
It does, I must say, seem like perhaps she should have thought more about the fact that, I wrote these parents as doing something that made their child want to run off and live by himself in the woods, where he would be subject to, first of all, big cats. Delkie gets eaten by a tiger or something. And second of all, by the implacable alien organism that consumes all organic matter it touches, that falls from the sky at
unpredictable intervals
every couple days. So if your child is doing that, you fucked up really badly.
Yep. I do have a broad question about the American cultural narrative of running away from home as a child. There are a lot of stories that treat that as a very like, yeah, it just happens, my side of the mountain. And I'm like, really? How many people actually tried to run away from home as a child? Because I was a deeply unhappy child, not because of anything my parents were doing, but because of my own mental and emotional situation. And I never tried to run away from home. I don't know. I just can't relate to it.
Well, I think it speaks both to an awareness on the part of children's book writers that children are often deeply unhappy in their home situations, even if for practical reasons they wouldn't consider running away, such that running away might be a desirable fantasy for them. And also perhaps to a certain anxiety on the part of parents about the prospect of children escaping your control that leads to this narrative being so culturally prominent.
One of the things that comes up in Redis's relationship with his family and their control is his disability, both in the sense that, as I mentioned, there's a question of medical negligence, but also in the way that his disability becomes a further locus of their control.
Yes.
This idea of, because you can't walk comfortably for long distances, we have a greater degree of infantilization towards you. We have a greater degree of control over your ability to come and go and move around. And we exercise that control in, again, this similar way of, we're expressing our concern for you and we're covering this control with a show of love, but it is an exertion of control.
Yeah. The moment that really got me is after the storm.
When he goes to render medical assistance to the dolphins without his parents' knowledge, and he gets caught and his parents are angry. And to be fair, they did lose a valuable piece of healing technology. They lost the book that they had been keeping all these records from Ivis. And that was irresponsible of them because they are tweens. Jage is ordering him to come back and says, get your shoes on. Let's not have another thorn in your foot. Rhetus felt a hard, cold feeling in his chest at that harsh remark. His father never referred to his limp, had never before reminded him of the injury or where he had taken it. So there is this, okay, so as soon as you are
disobedient,
resisting my control, I am going to try and leverage your disability against you.
Yeah, I'm thinking also about afterwards, he throws himself into doing the work that he's quote unquote supposed to be doing with humans. And then first of all, we get similarly to Menelia, like, I can't go back there right now. The same feeling that she has with the cottage in Dragonsinger. I can't be under that roof. But also a certain amount of, I'm exhausted and I can't walk this far. And when he's woken up the next morning by his sister, after having slept in the animal shed, she's like, everyone's been looking for you. Mother's freaking out. And Rhetus is like, I couldn't make it. And in the moment, he is like, that's not entirely true. But then also he starts walking and he's like, maybe it was actually. So there's a, he can be treated as if he's entirely able-bodied as long as it's convenient for them for control purposes. And he can be treated as if he is useless and disabled as long as that's convenient for them for control purposes. And also this, he has the specter of, he's expected to be the holder, but also he's got a younger brother who doesn't have an injured leg.
And I think that's explicitly called out, isn't it?
For context, Rhetus has been studying at the school at Landing that Master Robinson set up. And they go on a school field trip to Honshu, where Felessen is now living basically full-time as the caretaker. Felessen gives them a tour, and then he and Rhetus have a long conversation, where Rhetus is a little bit like, is this a hero crush thing, or is this a crush thing? And then Felessen asks him, like, what's your major gonna be, and what do you want to do with your life? And Rhetus is like, well, I don't know.
And then after that conversation, he's talking to Talion about the possibility of getting scuba equipment and about the fact that he talked to Felessen, and he's thinking about the fact that it would be useful to him to have a connection with dolphins if he is in fact going to be the Lord Holder of Paradise River Hold, that it is a sea hold. And he thinks, and who knows when or if, and Rhetus slapped the knee of his withered leg, I get to be holder. My father's a healthy man. Felessen's word at Honshu came back to him. What are you going to do in the time between? Then there was his younger brother, Anskono, with both legs in good working order and growing stronger and taller every year. Rhetus could be passed over in favor of his unimpaired younger brother.
Yeah, so he's conscious of his disability as something that is looming over his future. And, you know, it is. It does through the whole book, clearly. Well, once it happens.
I don't really get a strong feeling about whether Rhetus wants to be Lord Holder or just feels like he's supposed to want to be Lord Holder, because it seems pretty clear that he likes being a dolphineer. I don't know that those are necessarily mutually exclusive, but
when it comes down to it, we simply don't ever see Rhetus doing any Lord Holder stuff. We're told that Jaeg is teaching him about holder responsibilities, that he knows how to keep accounts, that he knows how to do some field work and also supervise it and things like that. But we don't actually see him doing that. So we don't know whether he likes it or not, but it certainly doesn't seem to be something that he's actively interested in as much as something that he knows is expected of him and that he has emotionally prepared himself to do when the time comes. But I feel like the fact that his answer when Felessen asks him about it is like, well, I'm going to be holder someday, I guess, suggests to me that he's not actively interested in being holder as much as aware that this is what is expected of him.
Yeah. And Rhetus's disability is not the only time that it comes up in this book. There's also a scene with Old Ive, the master healer, who does have a hunchback. And he is interacting with dolphins, as we previously mentioned, in Fort Hold, because it turns out the dolphins can use their sonar as a rudimentary X-ray, MRI?
Yeah, something.
They can tell when there are things inside the human body that are not normally there, question mark?
Yeah.
This apparently was an ability that was previously used by medical professionals on Pern and possibly on Earth, since the dolphins had this ability on Earth as well. And they renew its use. Where they're like, oh, okay, the dolphins can sense cancerous growths, the dolphins can sense pregnancy, the dolphins can sense some other things, and the dolphins do notice Old Ives' disability.
Yeah, they comment on it explicitly in a way that breaks the social contract of we have to pretend that people are not disabled because the dolphins don't have that social convention.
And the fact that the dolphin can notice that he has a bad back is part of what convinces him that the dolphin sonar is possible. And I also do think that Old Ive is one of the better portrayals of physical disability in these books.
Yeah.
Because mostly he just does his job.
Yeah. And his disability is consistently mentioned and it does narratively impact him. He sometimes needs a hand doing stuff, dealing with stairs, but it is neither moralized nor overplayed nor underplayed, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No magical cures, no inspiration points. Porn. He's just a guy with some physical disabilities and also a job to do.
Yeah.
We also do, once again, spend some time with Camo. Still ain't good, folks. Still ain't good.
Yeah.
He comes with Mentally as her childminder for Robs, since she is both pregnant and working full-time as the harper for this hold.
I should say the audiobook that I listened to from the 90s reads Mentally's child's name as Robsy, which makes more apparent the fact that his name is Rob Benton and Siebel combined.
Oh, okay. Robsy. That's still very bad.
But I just mention it because truly she cannot let us forget that Mentally and Siebel are both in love with Robinson.
No, and she shouldn't. So when they arrive and they're trying to figure out where people can sleep and logistics, okay, we can put a cot here, there's a room. And they're just casually like, oh, or I can settle Camo in the store shed. That way he's near but not underfoot all the time.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck, bro? It's fine. He could just sleep in the storage shed?
It's not good.
And this is supposed to be, wow, so inspirational, so great that they're so nice to him, because clearly it's bad to be mean to him, but that's fine.
Yeah, she could have just left him behind. He didn't need to reappear in this, but everyone, I guess, needs to reappear. So he's back. The other thing that you had flagged that I had forgotten about until you pointed it out is the reference to the fact that dragons never impress a human with a quote-unquote drudge personality.
And I just want to ask McCaffrey. She's dead, so I can't. I want a seance in which I ask Anne McCaffrey. So Anne, what are you picturing here? Are you picturing a situation where at the age of, say, 5 or 6, all of the parents on Pern evaluate their children and say, you have a drudge personality. So instead of educating you, we're going to have you do unfree labor for the rest of your life. Bye. Is that what you're picturing? Really? Really? Because it's so clear from the outside that being a drudge is something you are born into and cannot escape, and that there are probably quite a variation of personalities that those people have before they are treated like drudges and subjected to servitude and not educated for the rest of their life.
Yeah, no, but some people are just born to labor for others, apparently.
Well, unfortunately, the implication that I do see is this idea of, okay, a drudge personality means an intellectual disability, which has been the implication. And so it does seem like Anne McCaffrey is actually picturing that when your child is a toddler, if they have some kind of intellectual disability, you're just like, bye, kid, not going to raise you as my child anymore. Now you just become a servant. And that she thinks everyone on Pern is chill about that.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm thinking about is the constant focus on especially girls as being biddable, which is also one of the most egregious things in this book, is that not only does Mentally hide dolphins from Rhetus, but also as she's talking to the various parents at Paradise River Hold, she explicitly praises Alemi's children in conversation with his wife because they're such biddable children, his two daughters, as if this is a good thing, which again makes no sense coming from Mentally of all people, Mentally, who told Patterin, what's wrong with being a big, strong girl? Hello?
Yeah.
Where's the line between being biddable in a good way and being a drudge personality?
Clearly being born to the aristocracy versus not.
Well, apparently, yeah. It's just a mess.
That's always.
And we're going to talk a lot more about class when we get to Dragon's Eye.
And talk more about disability and drudgery when we get to Master Harper.
Uh-huh. So there are a couple other character things that I did want to talk about. One is just Miriam's good again in this.
We love to see it.
Miriam's back, and we see her in T'Gelin. I'm a little unclear about what Miriam's status in the Weir is, because T'Gelin is the Weir leader at Eastern Weir, and when he's disciplining T'Lion, there's no sign of the Weir woman, but Miriam, a Green Rider, is there, as if she is also in charge. I don't know what that is supposed to mean or what's going on with that. But anyway, T'Gelin and Miriam get mad at T'Lion because he's been not hiding the fact that he's working with the dolphins. But throughout this whole thing, Miriam is perfectly pleasant to be around. She's taken aback by the dolphin telling her she might be pregnant. But when they go to meet the dolphins, T'Gelin's the one who's a little bit like, I don't know. And Miriam's the one who's like, oh, T'Gelin, they're so much fun. They're splashing around. They splash her. And T'Lion's like, oh, this is so embarrassing. They're getting my Weir leader and his Weir mate wet. And Miriam's like, I'm the one who went into the water. What was I expecting? Finally, Miriam lives up to the promise of her character in Dragon Song 10 books later.
Maybe she was just having a really, really bad decade.
She was, to be fair, having a really bad decade. Maybe it makes sense to talk about T'Lion's character arc here, because I love T'Lion.
He's a good egg.
He sort of falls into the background, but early in the book, when Redis is still 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, T'Lion is really the main character that we see interacting with dolphins, and he's just really fun, especially because, speaking of childhood and power, he's in this interesting position as the rider of a fully grown dragon, but also a teenager.
So he's kind of a weirling, but not a weirling in a weird way.
Yeah, notionally, he's supposed to be accorded the privileges and the respect that is due to a dragon rider, but also when he goes to landing, the cook can be like, T'Lion, come on, I need you to help carry food. Go deliver this food to the conference room. And I stuck some meat rolls on there for you too, but go do chores for me. Obviously, we do see adult dragon riders get co-opted into this sometimes, but it wouldn't be like that.
Because of this, he has this weird social position where he does have all of these very disparate adults who feel a kind of paternal fondness for him, where they do feel comfortable suborning him to do chores and giving him extra snacks, which we see within Weirs, but I don't think we've previously seen for adults outside of the Weir and a child with a dragon.
Agreed. It puts him in a really narratively interesting spot where he's in a suspended, he should be an adult, but also everyone recognizes that he's not an adult. And he's very conscious of, he's introduced for the first time when he goes to pick up Alemi to take him to landing to report on the dolphins. And he's like, all right, Master Alemi, I'm here to pick you up. And Alemi's like, okay, can Gadareth bend down so I can climb up? Can you give me a hand so I can climb up? And T'Lion's like, oh, right. Oh my God. Of course. Yeah. It's really endearing. And it also sets up then a dynamic where Alemi is like, okay, well, obviously he's a dragon rider, but also he's 12.
Yeah.
It puts T'Lion in a really fun place.
And there is this kind of mentorship relationship between him and Alemi that grows into more of a relationship of equals as the book continues.
Yeah.
And they're both investigating dolphineering in a way that's fun.
Yeah. And it also then means he's positioned interestingly relative to Redis because he's older than Redis and has these responsibilities. So he can, for example, be the person supervising Redis when Redis is swimming, but also they're close enough in age that they can hang out. There's a couple of scenes, including after Redis has talk to Felesin, where Redis is in his dorm room at landing and T'Lion is just wandering in and out of his room talking to him, chatting about their plans for they're gonna get scuba gear and all this stuff. I'm like, this is very Fallon and Robinson, as we'll see in Master Harper.
We'll get there.
But they're very conscious of T'Lion's status as dragon rider, but also young. So T'Lion is like, well, I could probably ask the Smithcraft to make us some of this equipment, but I would be way down on the priority list, basically because I'm young and because it's such a weird request. So maybe it would be better if we ask Alemi to do it for us because he's a master fisher and not just some random dragon rider and a young one at that. And also it's obviously relevant for his craft work, so it might be slightly higher priority, although also Iva's stuff is going on, so everything's going to be below that. There's just all these kind of layers of status that are going on. This book is perhaps not as class conscious as some of the other books in this series, but it is thinking a lot about age in an interesting way.
Yeah.
Speaking of class and age and status. The other thing that's going on, as I indicated at the beginning, is this book is all about social and political changes in a bunch of different ways. And one of those is the political structure is changing. The part of the Toric plot is a transition from ad hoc cooperation between Weirs and Halls and Holds to a much more systematic, we have a planetary government now. The Lord Holders met collectively and asked the Weir leaders to distribute the land on the southern continent because none of the Lord Holders could be impartial about it, whereas the Dragon Riders are at least more impartial about it.
Valar and Lessa are becoming king and queen of Pern more and more clearly with every book.
Yeah, and that is what gives them the political position to intervene when Toric is trying to claim land because, well, the authority to distribute land on the southern continent has been legally delegated to us. So you can't take this land. It's not yours to give. It is ours to ensure the fair distribution of. So this is something that we saw already a bit in All the Weirs of Pern with Duram, Lytol, and Robinton administering landing and that transition towards a unified governance structure rather than everyone being fully autonomous. Is something that is clearly continuing here.
Although they do still love autonomy, they have to shout out that dolphin paws are autonomous because everyone has to be autonomous.
Yeah, autonomy is the buzzword. It's what everyone wants.
But we're also seeing that they need that level of unification because we are moving towards a more industrial structure. We're moving towards a more interconnected economic structure across the planet than they had previously.
Right, Fandorel's developing radios.
Right.
He actually specifically tells us that his radios are better than the ancients' radios, which I thought was interesting because I think it's the only indication that we've had since Dragon Quest of actual indigenous technological development on Pern.
He was working on telegraph, and then we kind of got sidetracked by Ivis, and now we have radios.
Yeah.
We also have a vague reference to the fact that there was a runner-based communication system, but I don't think we're going to learn more about that until the short story.
Runner of Pern, yeah. So it's clear that they're moving towards a higher technological level, even if they're still explicitly are like, well, we're never going to be on the same level as the ancients, and we don't really want to be. But also, the Minercraft and the Smithcraft are talking about setting up a joint craft hall to industrialize iron and steel production in the southern continent. So it seems like, among other things, the strict divisions between the crafts as these autonomous guilds are maybe on their way out. One of the other things that happens in this book is that the Harpercraft Hall completely reorganizes themselves and essentially abandons music. They're just going to be teachers now, and they're focused on developing a new whole educational program that's not music-centered, which is funny, as we'll talk about in Dragon's Eye, because in Dragon's Eye, we see them make the opposite decision.
And I think it's relevant that Threadfall is coming to an end, that some of the social pressures that have been holding Pern in this static guild system and with this hold autonomy were the pressure of Threadfall.
Yeah.
And now that that is potentially being removed, there's a lot more, well, why can't you be a dragon rider and also own land? Why can't you be in two crafts? There isn't the need for this anymore. So I think that combined with the revelation of like, hey, there are other ways to do things. We did things differently in the past is part of what is unlocking this change in Pernese society.
Yeah. Something that you had mentioned also was the ways that environmentalism and the idea of sustainability is becoming an issue again, right? Because as they are reindustrializing, they are starting to think like, well, okay, we know now what our ancestors were trying to get away from. So how do we make sure that we don't recreate that?
And I think in some ways that is a little naive, as we have spoken of in the past. There are some ways in which once you start to industrialize production, you lose economic viability of individual crafting, artisan work, in a way that's kind of, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
But it is possible to consciously and conscientiously develop higher technological base and higher industrial capacity without fucking your environment up. And it does seem like they're thinking about that in a way that made me be like, oh yeah, it's the 90s now. You know, we're she's writing this in a post-Captain Planet world. And we're really thinking maybe even outside of the books, McCaffrey is thinking more about environmentalism than she was in the 60s and 70s.
There's a shift in how people are thinking. There's still the concern that the world is going to become uninhabitable, but we're moving away from the concern that the world is going to become uninhabitable because of overpopulation and towards the concern that the world is going to be uninhabitable because of global warming, which was apparently popularized after 1988. So the other thing that I thought was really interesting, thinking also about the environment in this book, is the extent to which this book is really, and I think probably unintentionally, but very strongly leaning into a bunch of classic colonial tropes about the colonial environment as something that is hostile to the life of the colonist. There is, of course, all of these environmental dangers, tropical fevers, the thorn that ends up damaging Redis's leg. There's these sudden horrible storms. There's the horrible hurricane that sweeps through. And thinking about it in these terms, I think Aramina stands out as very much the wife of a colonial administrator. That's her role, is to be the delicate white woman who is bringing civilization to this.
The jungle.
The jungle, yeah. And I think also that positions the dolphins really interestingly, because they are then this kind of liminal entity that is not quite animal, but also not quite human, and that Aramina responds to by being like, we have to violently exclude these beings from the realm of civilization. They are nature. They are something that we can use if they are useful to us, but they are not something that we can ever accept as being on the same level as us, which has a certain racial politic to it.
Yeah. Well, and also just the sheer fury and outrage when Talion and Redis are giving the dolphins medical help.
Yeah.
Because Talion and Redis are like, the most serious human injury was bruising, some scrapes. And we had two or three dolphins who were going to die unless they received immediate medical attention. So we figured that was a higher priority. And then are being told by these adults, like, not only is that untrue, but how dare you even suggest that?
Right. Redis says the dolphins are part of Paradise River Hold because they inhabit these waters. This is where they live too. And Aramina's like, categorically, the dolphins are not and cannot be part of Paradise River Hold. So in addition to everyone is struggling to adjust to the fact that there's another intelligent species on the planet, there's a policing of the boundaries of who and what we care about. We care about humans, and we care about only humans, plus dragons and maybe fire lizards. But also there's an extent to which dragons are an extension of the human, right? Dragons and their riders are in some ways indistinguishable. The dragon is the rider is the dragon. There were also a few miscellaneous continuity things that came up again. Name days. It seems like they're just birthdays. We're explicitly told that Swacky's name day is to celebrate 70 years of his life, but also she calls them name days, which does kind of imply that Pern has a calendar of saints, and one of them is Saint Swacky.
I'm committing hard to Saint Swacky. It just hasn't come up before or since in the narrative, and that's okay.
The timeline is generally a mess. We do get a bunch of explicit indications of how old Redis is, but the indications that we get of how old Redis is don't line up with other things we know about when Jake and Aramina came to Southern.
When all the Weirs of Pern is happening.
Yeah, so it's just a mess. Alemi, once again, knows what parts of speech are. He makes a reference to adverbs in a section that's vocalized through him, so I am forced to conclude that Schoolhouse Rock is among the teaching ballads, presumably heavily adapted because they don't have storefronts in the way that Lolly 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 Get Your Adverbs Here implies.
You could adapt that for a gather stall.
I actually went through all of Grammar Rock to be like, which if any of these songs would work on Pern, and the answer is only verb if you omit the baseball section, which is sort of spoken, so you could probably omit the baseball section. And then I got really distracted because I was imagining Pederin of all people as Verb the superhero in the Verb song, and mentally as the backing singers singing That's What's Happening. It's a lot to imagine.
I love this for you. Because we are explicitly told that they're reviving baseball,
mm-hmm,
in a way that makes it seem like Pern lost all concept of organized sports.
Yeah, which seems a little implausible.
Along with paper and literature.
The only sports we see them do are foot races and runner races, and that's it.
Yeah.
So do children not play games?
No, they sing songs about adverbs and nothing else.
I guess, yeah.
Also, I love the fact that the three sports that the Pernese people are like, that's what we're going to bring back, are baseball, soccer, and polo.
I mean, frankly, I'm surprised they didn't already have polo.
Right. You're obsessed with horses, all of you.
That seems so playable, yeah. But apparently it's back now. Robinson's death scene happens again. I don't believe it at all. Someone sends Jake and Aramina a fire lizard note. Jake reads it and immediately collapses on the railing, sobbing. And Redis takes it to Aramina, and she collapses, sobbing. And then we get this scene of 12-year-old Redis carrying this note through the whole hold and showing it to everyone he meets, and he's like, I don't understand what's going on, and they read it and they immediately start crying, and it's like every single person in the hold sobbing, they're collapsing against the tree and up in tears, and I'm like, I just don't believe this. Jake and Armina have met Robinton. He gave them political support when they were laying legal claim to their hold. I can believe that they would feel a certain amount of personal grief about this. But when it's his Aunt Temma, no, sorry, she's not bursting into tears that Robinton is dead.
And yet.
But anyway, and yet. And then finally, as we mentioned, Oderol's there. At the climax of this book, if you read All the Rivers of Pern or listened to our episode where we talked a little bit about it, you may remember that Lord Oderol of Tillic dying was a fairly significant plot element in that book.
They spend quite a lot of time trying to figure out which of his sons to choose as the next Lord Holder. There's a whole very incoherent, mathematically confusing vote about it. We spend multiple chapters on this.
But he's back from the dead to celebrate Rhaedys as the first Dolphineer.
And to be fair, there's overlap, right? At the beginning of this book, he's alive, because at the beginning of this book, All the Weirs of Pern has not yet happened. But by the end of this book, All the Weirs of Pern has pretty clearly happened. Robinton is dead, so Oderel should also be dead.
I have to conclude that she just got confused and had Oderel and Ranrol switched in her head or something. I will note that in contrast to Dragon's Eye, she does not thank the Pern fan community for providing continuity editors. Not that it made a significant difference in Dragon's Eye either, but at least they were there. Oderel necromancy is what happens when you don't have the continuity editors, I guess.
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted to talk about, just sort of in passing, is that at the end of this book, when Rhaedys is reunited with his family and Aramina's sobbing, and I'm like, I don't believe for a second that you are actually sad or guilty about this. Or other, I think that you're sad that your son has escaped your control, but I don't think that you actually understand the stakes of what you did to him.
And I also think you're embarrassed that you are having all of these people in your social community, many of whom are very high status, seeing that your son has run away from home and seeing it as a referendum on your parenting.
Yes. Anyway, one of the things that happens is that all of the political leaders are like, yeah, we talked it over with your parents, and they had a chance to meet and speak with the Tillic Teresa. So she asked us, Jake said, looking slightly embarrassed, while Aramina ducked her head and nervously twitched the hem of her tunic, one of her gather tunics, Rhaedys now noticed, if we objected to your becoming a Dolphineer. Rhaedys waited. It is an honor to be asked, his mother said softly, hesitantly, before raising her head to look at him straight in the eye. I was once asked to accept an honor, she shot Lessa a quick glance, and could not. I cannot stand in your way, Rhaedys. So this is wild to me, both because in Renegades, and also implied at the end of The Girl Who Heard Dragons, we were presented with Aramina's decision not to go to the Weir as because she didn't want to, for a variety of reasons, including that she was, you know, overwhelmed hearing all dragons all the time, but also because she didn't want to leave her family, didn't want the life of a weirwoman. But here it seems like we're being asked to reevaluate that as an act of cowardice.
I don't know that I insist on that. Two things. One, I think you can parse I could not do it as a failure, but also just like I could not bring myself to do it as an act of volition.
I feel like either way, it still implies an I should have done it, but I didn't.
Yes. But two, she's also looking at Lessa when she says it.
She is looking at Lessa.
So I think there is something to the fact that Lessa is not the kind of woman who you look straight in the face and say, you've made a mistake or I don't agree with you unless you want to die. And Aramina is someone who very clearly exerts control over people who are lower in the social hierarchy than she is, but does not frequently attempt to resist control from people higher in the social hierarchy than she is.
True. Yeah.
So I could absolutely see an Aramina who is like, fuck this, I'm not a dragon rider, looking at Lessa and being like, it's such a shame that I couldn't be a dragon rider.
You know what? Yeah, that's fair enough. Either way, I think it's an interesting character moment for Aramina, who is generally done quite poorly in this book. She seemed perfectly likable in The Girl Who Heard Dragons.
Yeah.
And she made maybe the most interesting choice in the whole series of any character in Renegades. And here she's awful, just pretty unmitigatedly from start to finish. But this moment at the end is at least there's something going on here. And I don't know that I like it, but there's something going on here that's not just, and she's a horrible person now.
I could imagine, and here we are once again with the fake good version of Pern that lives only in our head, a version of Aramina who made all of the same bad choices, but for interesting and compelling psychological reasons, right? Mm. I could see a version of Eremina who was deeply traumatized by her experiences hearing dragons against her will and being kidnapped and literally faked her death and ran away from her entire life and her family to avoid this, seeing her six-year-old getting pulled into this and having a really uncontrolled and unhealthy trauma response of keep my child safe, keep my child away from this, which is then exacerbated by the fact that he gets severely injured. I could see that, but that's not the actual Eremina that we're given.
Yeah.
And I do think it is reading it, if not against the text, but the text is not giving us any of that. I'm putting all of that there in a way that I think could have given you the same plot with more depth and making her more sympathetic.
Yeah.
Because to your point, she just wakes up and is a mean and controlling person. And you're like, well, all right, I guess we're doing that today.
And Jaeg is there. Part of it also is Jaeg was also a pleasant enough character in Renegades of Pern. Not particularly interesting, but not boring and not bad.
And also very willing to do unusual things and run away and change his life. And now is, again, coming down hard on, no, you have to be a holder just like me and you have to be obedient.
You have to be just like me.
Yeah. They both seem to have become much more conservative socially and politically since they were young, which is, I guess, something that can happen. But we're also not seeing that as a transition. We're just presented with it.
Yeah. And again, you could rationalize it.
Right.
Now they have land, they have status. There's stakes now to their choices in a way that there weren't in the same way when they were 18 and 20 or whatever. Yeah. But we don't see that progression.
Yeah.
We just see the before and the after and none of the how they got there. So the after feels completely disconnected from the before.
And I think it does harken back to her ongoing issue where her villains don't have a reason that explains their choices. They don't have their own logical motivations that conflict with the protagonist. They just wake up one morning and decide to be evil.
Yeah. On that note,
wake up this morning and decide to read a different, better book.
Well, yeah, I like Dolphins of Pern. I do think it's good. I don't know that I would rank it at the top, but I probably would put it in the top three of all Pern books for me.
I think top five for sure. But I also don't know that I think it really works if you have no idea of what happened in All the Weirs of Pern.
It did for me as a child, clearly, but I agree that it would work better if you've read All the Weirs of Pern, and it's definitely not worth reading All the Weirs of Pern just to read this book. So if you're interested in a book that you can read by itself that is good, I would recommend C.J. Cherry's Pride of Chatnor, which is a novel about first contact with an alien being where part of the galactic society that the main characters are part of not only doesn't understand, but doesn't really want to understand and instead wants to exploit and abuse the alien beings that you have made contact with. It's got some interesting handling of multi-species interactions, and I'm very pointedly avoiding saying more because parts of it would be spoilers, but it does have cat aliens, so that's fun.
I was really torn between two recommendations by the same author, and so I'm going to kind of half recommend both of them, in that I think both The Deep and Sauraland by Rivers Solomon are good books that are worthy of recommending to your attention. And I think they both partially come to bear on the same themes and concepts as Dolphins of Pern. The Deep is about mermaids who are descendants of pregnant enslaved people who had been thrown overboard from slave ships, have developed their own underwater society, and are now considering how to make contact again with the humans up on the surface and thinking about first contact or kind of a first contact, but also about reestablishing a contact that has long been gone. And Sauraland is about a woman who runs away into the woods to escape from an oppressive society and has to then reckon with living separately from that society or trying to return and improve it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dragons Made Me Do It. If you enjoyed it and want to hear more, you can follow us on Tumblr at dmmdipodcast.tumblr.com. for updates or to send us questions or comments, and you can find our archive of episodes, along with transcripts, recommendations, funny memes, and more at dmmdipodcast.neocities.org, N-E-O-Cities.